Hello, this is Matt Hale bringing you the Art Monthly talk show once again. And Art Monthly is a podcast primarily, but it began and still does go out on Resonance 104 FM. And we're very grateful to them for having done that for many years. They support us hugely, and we try to support them back by providing a programme, which they continue very happily to take from us. Now, today, in our one-hour programme, which is meant to encourage you to read the magazine, and the magazine in particular this time is July-August 2026, issue 498 of Art Monthly, in which we will be discussing two features. Now, the first feature we're going to discuss is by Dan Rees, who is an artist and writer. And that's Rees, R-E-E-S, Dan, although your email address has a different Rees, which I'm intrigued by. But why do you use two different names in your world?
That's just because Rees with the double E is too common.
Oh, for Gmail.
Yeah, I'd have to.
Oh, I see. So it's not
100 or something.
So it is your name is Rees, E-E-S.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's Dan Rees. And you're an artist and writer, but that's what we've got, how we describe you in the magazine.
Yeah.
That's correct. Do you want to pad out that in any way? Do you do anything? I mean, how else would you describe yourself, perhaps?
I mean, so basically for the past 20 years or so, I've been exhibiting as an artist. And just wasn't really engaged with writing so much. But then probably the last 6 or 7 years, I went back and studied aesthetic theory and have been essentially kind of conducting a kind of my own sort of PhD project, you know.
So not one with the university, just research for your work, for your artwork, or link to your artwork.
It's in a way it's the relationship between philosophy and art, and I guess a big part of that is the idea of art, the role art criticism plays in kind of unraveling the concept of the artwork itself. So it's a way of understanding art that doesn't take necessarily the artist's intention for their work as the kind of ultimate authority, but tries to read the artwork as like a social product, and then sort of kind of determine various layers within the work, not only its content, but actually primarily its form. It's the contradictions that take place within its form. And
okay, that's very, very interesting, because and we will talk about it in a second, but that work that relates to your choice of writing about fundamentally one artwork,
yeah,
in your feature. And just to say hello, Bob Dickinson, hi. Thanks for joining us as well. We will be discussing your feature following on from Dan's. You're a freelance writer and you're based in Manchester and Bariloche, and I hope I said that right, in Argentina.
It's Bariloche. Yes.
Bariloche, of course it is.
I'm not there, I'm here.
In Manchester at the moment. So your clock is the same as ours.
It is.
Because we're all in the UK.
Yes.
I think you're in Wales, aren't you, Dan?
I am.
Okay. Well, let's move on. To your feature, Dan, Bob, just to say, though, you've been involved in broadcasting for years, writing for Art Monthly for years, but am I right in saying you're not an artist?
No, I'm a writer.
You're a writer. So yeah. There's a difference between the two of you in that sense. But you've produced lots of, and I always sit in fear, really, when I'm facing you, because you've produced many radio programmes over the years.
Yeah, I stopped doing that now. That was a while ago.
But you know how to. So I always think, oh, my God. Okay, right. No, I actually think, great, you're on, because you'll help me, because you understand how things go. So to begin with, Dan, your feature in Art Monthly, we called on human dignity. I don't know if that's what you called it, but what I was particularly interested in was this, not to tell you how to talk about it, but if you could, you talk about Walter Benjamin, mm-hmm. and this his definition of allegory and its relationship yeah. to symbol, but and you apply many thoughts to Sung. Now I'm going to say this wrong, probably Thieu's.
No, that's right.
Installation for the German Pavilion in Venice Biennale this year, 2026. And you basically really deeply analyse her work. So perhaps we ought to just let you describe what it is, not necessarily what you think about it, but just so people know, what are we actually talking about in terms of what was it physically like?
So what Sung did was she made a kind of facade around the existing German pavilion, and with mosaic tiles, essentially reconstructed an image of a Plattenbau building, which is basically a kind of socialist prefabricated concrete complex in the east part of Berlin that's currently being taken down. And this is a huge area, and these nine gigantic identical buildings. And basically Sung took one part of one building, photographed it in, like, you know, in great detail, had those images reproduced in mosaic tiles, and then sort of superimposed over the top of the existing German pavilion. And so what it means is that from a distance, if you just sort of catch the pavilion through the trees, it looks like a prefabricated concrete building, because the mosaic tile sort of, like, if you have enough distance, the image completes as into a whole, and it looks like like this strange brutalist building that's just been dropped in the Venice Biennale.
And it's hiding what underneath sort of columns, like based on the Roman, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. So
that are there normally. So the building normally looks like, what kind of architecture is the normal pavilion?
It's a national socialist architect, 1938, I think, and that so it's this kind of neoclassicism, basically.
That's underneath.
So rather than interfere with the architectural forms, she's just kind of wrapped the forms.
And when you get up close, it looks different. So
when you get up close, the illusion sort of dissolves. So you understand that, you know, the image is actually flat, and the window holes aren't window holes. And then the mosaic tiles begin to emerge, and you have a different experience of the building. And the mosaics themselves were made in Italy with a kind of artisan mosaic maker, and they've all been made, you know, in a painstaking fashion. So they're quite beautiful.
If you looked at one piece,
yeah.
Just so I'm clear, would it be one flat color?
Yes.
And then but they're different colors, perhaps, are they?
Exactly. So they're all, yeah, exactly. So they're just, it's a bit, maybe it's a bit like pointillism. So it's just, it close up, it sort of descends into a bit of a mess because you can't quite make out why these colors are arranged as they are. But then you step back and you begin to see what they're intimating.
But what do they intimate?
Well, it's really just the facade of this specific building.
So it's quite subtle stuff. It does sound quite subtle. It's not like, you know, it's not like there's figures or faces or anything, you know, that you might get in a mosaic.
Yeah,
often, you know, I know you get, or even patterns necessarily.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a repurposing in a way, clearly, of mosaic in order to do something that's quite contradictory, which is to then, you know, use these delicate kind of glistening mosaic tiles to sort of image a brutalist socialist era building.
Quite a tough call to achieve in reality, you know, that kind of complicated layering of architectural history and types of forms. I mean, concrete is much cruder than mosaic, But you think it achieves that look?
It definitely achieves that look. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's uncanny in a way because when you see the photos, you can see the underlying pavilion because you can see the columns.
Right.
It feels a bit like it's something's been draped over the top of it. But then you also read the image of the concrete building. So it just creates a strange image. But if you were going to Venice for the first time and you weren't familiar with how the pavilion, German pavilion, actually looked, you know, for a moment you may have thought the German pavilion was a concrete building until you got a bit closer.
Gotcha. And just because I'm slightly concerned, there's a lot of in your piece we can talk about, but perhaps with time. Why has she done this, do you think? Because this is the complicated part. And I think I get in the idea that that points in your piece, I'm feeling you might think she doesn't succeed, or is there are issues with what she's trying to do, but perhaps you might try to tell us what that is.
Yeah, well, it's I think that the first thing to say is that the context of the German pavilion in Venice and the whole system of national representation just brings like a lot of baggage that's very difficult for a critic, you know, for an artist who's trying to make work that's critical of national representation, those kind of ideas. It's already you know, there's already a layer of complicity that you're having to deal with, and then the German pavilion has its own very specific history, that it's got this national socialist history. You know, it's a building that is really a you know, speaks to a terrible period in German history. And so the compulsion for every German artist is to somehow deal with this, you know. And that in itself, I think, can be like a real something that really would trip people up. But I think so. What Sung has basically done, which I thought was important, is achieve something with all the different layers of mediation, all these different. So you've got the history of the German pavilion, you've got the context of the Venice Biennale, which is this strange national representation and this strange moment where the art world kind of descends every 2 years. And there's this sort of new context defining moment. And, you know, it's like the last 2 years are kind of washed away and here's the new agenda set. And it's this slightly utopian, dystopian arrangement. And then you've got Sung's own kind of personal history, because she lived in the building as a child. And
in the one in Berlin.
Exactly. And then the history of the Vietnamese migrant workers, of which her father was one, and that's where he came over from Vietnam. And what happened to those workers when the Berlin Wall came down, and after reunification, they were basically left in a kind of limbo, because all of their workers' rights were agreed in accordance with the GDR. And once that no longer existed, these Vietnamese workers, of which there were like, you know, thousands, were just left in totally insecure positions. And so this building then takes on many lives, because it went from various layers of instability in a way. And I think with the, you know, what the mosaic does which is interesting, is that it kind of enacts this form of fragmentation of meaning. So part of I think the risk with something at the Venice Biennale is always that it's just this sensationalized monument to something, because in the attention economy, right, it's like you go to Venice and everyone's talking about which pavilions to see, and there's quickly emerges the top five, and there's this sort of like very strange sort of game that happens. And so Sung's work is monumental, and so she's entering into that, you know, she's entering into that like presence, but in a way the work only has a function, a critical function, through its fragmentation, you know, through the fact that it's the image of unity that it presents from a distance dissolves the closer you get. And so my argument was that it sort of had to go through that process of staging itself as this like, oh, easy symbol of the ruin of the German state or the ruin of German democracy or something like that. A metaphorical reading that people can feel happy that they understood. But then it kind of twists back on itself, and it's like, well, it needs to pass through that stage in order to perform the allegory and an allegorical concept that comes from Benjamin, which is actually different to the everyday use of.
I was going to say that it is, isn't it? Go on, tell us. Can you tell us? Well, without, yes, but it, you did use it quite strongly in your feature.
Yeah.
So it'd be great to try and.
Yeah. So it's something like the manner in which the unresolved contradictions of the past or the unresolved antagonisms of history persist in the present. And they persist through a kind of accumulation of ruin. And so what capitalism does and what historicism does is trying to neatly package that into a kind of narrative. You know, so something like Nazism, you'd say, well, that was a terrible thing, never again. Or with socialism, you'd say, nice idea, failed political project. And they're all sort of like the idea that those were necessary steps on a path to progress can somehow retrospectively justify what happened. And it creates this kind of narrative arc of progress. And Benjamin's just completely rejects that idea. And it's more the case that there's just this debris of stuff that's stacking up. And there's the progress is the big myth. And so the important point is that you try and maintain the concept of contradiction and instability of meaning.
Then you don't pretend otherwise.
Right. And there's a, you know, the point is that there's a kind of discomfort in that, because it means that some of those histories that you thought had been put to bed maybe haven't been. But that you know, that then reemerges in the discourse, because people say, well, oh, this is elements of fascism returning or something. Well, the critical theorists would say, well, it never went away, you know. But the point is that to produce an image of instability, right, you can't just produce a stable image of instability, because that then partakes in the symbolic. Right, so you have to produce, you have to enact or stage through aesthetic form an experience of instability, which is different to an image of instability. And part of the way that you stage an experience of instability might be by providing an image of stability. So you get an image of what you think you're looking at, and then through the encounter with the pavilion, it stages its own breakdown, and you then have to rethink what you're looking at and what layers of meaning you're dealing with.
So the work has to draw me in enough for me to then experience this need to question what I'm looking at.
Yeah.
Because if I don't get drawn in, I just see it as a whole image and walk away, or I don't understand it and I don't get... So given that, but you haven't mentioned the inside of the building at all.
So the inside...
Is that important part? Do people go in it even?
No, absolutely. So I should have maybe said this at the beginning. Two artists were involved in the German pavilion, Henrike Naumann and Sung Chu. And Henrike Naumann and Sung are both on the interior. Henrike has the main room and it's a very beautiful installation, but the works were conceived separately, but organized through the curator in such a way that they work together. Henrike's work also deals with themes regarding the GDR and Swiss history. Yeah.
But it's probably a more easily understood form of work.
It's
perhaps.
Yeah, it's in the sense that it's on the wall and it's...
Yeah, that's kind of the meaning.
Yeah.
And I know you don't really write about that work, so it's fine. I just wanted to... people to understand that we're not pretending that the building doesn't have
exactly
reality, as it were. It's very, very interesting. This concept of Benjamins, I thought you got that across well enough for me to understand it quite well. Why do you mention Paul Klee's Angelus Novus at the beginning of your feature?
That's just a little way of trying to, because I set up the idea that symbol and allegory are kind of in opposition, but in a way that it's more of a dialectical relationship. And so the idea that this image from Paul Klee Benjamin wrote about in his concept of history essay, and he basically sort of describes this image and uses it as a metaphor. So he uses it as a stable concept to try and understand allegory. And so there is something ironic there in a way that now that's become a kind of shorthand, the idea of like historical catastrophe piling up. And thoughts come in sort of consumable, easily digestible things that you can just sort of fit into little, you know, that's exactly what Benjamin was trying to avoid, because it's all about trying to promote thinking, trying to promote critical examination.
But Benjamin's.
Yeah. And yeah, the whole. Yeah, exactly. So that was just a little way of introducing like how within that image alone, there's a dialectical relationship between allegory and symbol, because that's become a kind of symbolized version of allegory.
Which is a contradiction. Bob, did you want to ask a question at all?
Yeah, I mean, when I was reading your article, Dan, I was thinking about the way that these arguments about different architectural styles and their meaning, their political meaning, and this idea of a endless kind of wreckage and ruination of political systems. How it's largely European, and coming from a sort of South American perspective, I'm quite interested in the way European architectural styles have been used in South America, often by European architects. And whether you have any thoughts about that?
I mean, the one interesting part of the Vietnamese GDR solidarity agreements was that they funded the building of Platten Bows in Vietnam.
Yeah.
So the architecture, you know, is found in Vietnam. I think that, you know, I tried to concentrate on the most sort of the elements that were the most strongly emerging from the work itself, and the context of Venice, which presents itself as this globalized, you know, but I see it really as a kind of very much a kind of European Western capitalist image of the globe, right? So it's a partial image to begin with, yeah. And so I felt like it was important to not draw it. So my essay in a way is quite negative in the sense that I don't offer a positive concept of human dignity. I'm trying to think through Chu's work to negatively critique something that's like a pillar of the German constitution that sort of used in her title.
We haven't actually mentioned the title. Did we mention it?
The title of Sung's work was Human Dignity Shall Become Inviolable, or something very close to that. And it's the first point on the new German, what was the new German constitution. And so it's this kind of universalized, administered concept of dignity, which again is, you know, potentially a kind of contradiction, you know, in itself. The only thing I would say is that in keeping it kind of wholly negative, I felt like the critical focus was sharper. And if I bring in like different cultures or different ways of thinking, it would become too expansive for what I was attempting to do.
You don't need to defend it. Yeah. but I mean, because it's quite conceptually complex just within its own design, isn't it?
And exactly.
It was Tia, do you think she was a Benjamin understander, as it were? Do you think that's where she's coming from? Or do you think it's just, is it actually, I don't know, some other way in which she's got to doing what she's done, but which actually does happen to fit with an understanding of Benjamin's definition of allegory?
Yeah, I think it's definitely the latter. I think she's not, she's certainly not taken that and as a starting point. But I think this is what the curious thing that happens with, you know, artists and then theories of like Benjamin and Adorno, who, you know, Adorno was really promoting like Samuel Beckett's work and the kind of negativity that exists in there. And there's something that artists sort of understand it intuitively. You know, it's you don't need necessarily to read all the reams and reams of justification. There's a kind of stylistic or like there's a sort of understanding of what of the critical function of negativity and how that operates within form. So, you know, put it this way, the idea of, you know, in order to critique capitalism, you don't necessarily do it directly. You have to maybe do it indirectly. And I think that's something a lot of artists understand intuitively.
Let's take that as a point of perhaps crossing over to Bob, because I think it's, I mean, intuitively, I shall now say something about your feature, but no, not intuitively, but basically I was struck by your feature on where you use the word hydrocene, which is a new word for me. But basically, you're very interested in an artist and talking about artists who are involved with water. And obviously, it's something which is universally, you know, we all should have water and share it. And obviously, they are making work which draws to attention the unfairness of its distribution.
Yeah.
Just to put it simply. But obviously, they're, as Dan was saying, to a sense, they're not necessarily, they may be working intuitively or very personally in their own based on their own experiences. Some of them may actually have more higher ambitions for their work to change the world, you know. And I'm very interested in that kind of the reality of that ambition. And whether art can do that or tell us a bit more to begin with, just about how you got started in writing about this area. I mean, I think we've called your piece Art and the Hydrocene.
Yeah. Well, it's a word I came across that's been coined by an Australian academic called Bronwyn Bailey Charteris. And when I first came across this word for the period we're living through, I thought, oh no, it's another word to replace, you know, Anthropocene, you know, which we're only just getting used to using the word Anthropocene.
Well, and that's been questioned a lot as well.
Questioned, yes. But I think these terms actually are quite useful just for getting people's attention directed towards the environmental crises, multi-crises that we're kind of living through. And sort of quite appropriately, I was writing this piece during a heat wave in the UK, and we're now, this week, right now, entering another heat wave, which is almost certainly being affected by environmental change. And but I was mainly, you know, from I live half the time in Argentina, and I've become very interested in contemporary artists from all over Latin America, and who I think are sort of underrepresented in Europe. So I wanted to write something about the experience of artists working now in South America in relation to the crisis that's affecting lots of Latin American countries about water availability.
And were you finding there were quite a lot of artists, just as you were looking at art, that this subject, as it were, or this area was coming up?
Yes, it's a really big subject because it's a really big event. That's, you know, these issues are politically very live at the moment.
And the realities of things like floods,
yeah,
or droughts, or
absolutely, yes, and also in relation to the way capitalism is changing in farming, and the availability of water is affected by these multi-corporate farming projects that are happening in places like Chile, which I write about in the article. But I mean, I started off with the idea of water being a form of trauma, really. The disaster that happened in Brazil in 2015, when a big dam, the Mariana Dam, burst and destroyed a village called Bento Rodrigues, when, you know, 43.7 million cubic meters of toxic waste escaped from a reservoir that was being held back by a tailings dam. A tailings is the byproducts of mining. In this case, it was iron ore mining. And so it didn't just inundate a complete village and then it went its it went down to the sea, it polluted everything because it was absolutely toxic. And so I started off by looking at this film called River of Mud that was made by a director called Tadeu Jungle, who's Brazilian, obviously. And, you know, it is lit. It is, I mean, the word immersive is a horrible word to use in relation to a disaster involving an inundation of water. But it is really like being immersed in this water, because he filmed it, you know, during the days following the escape of all this water. And you're literally following a camera, walking through sort of waist deep polluted water, talking, you know, he's interviewing survivors. You know, they don't know what to do. They've got no help from the government. Their homes have been completely destroyed. And of course, this disaster polluted something like 33,500 square miles of drainage area downriver. So it was an immense disaster that's never really, they haven't really been compensated. The people who have affected by it have never really been compensated for what happened.
And in a way, nothing would be enough, really, would it?
Oh no, of course not.
Did you say Jungle?
Yeah, it looks like jungle, but yeah, I think it's Jungle.
Did he create an installation, like an immersive installation? Yes, yeah. You go into a room and there's, yes, I imagine, videos on four walls or something, and you're sort of surrounded. I mean, it's sounds a little bit like an attempt at reenactment, you know, realism, sort of, in a way, you know, to try to shock the audience of this work,
yeah,
into experiencing something like the actual people did, in order that some change occurs, or some, you know, affecting people enough for them to do. I mean, this is the area of where I'm interested in art and what it can do. And
yes, I think it also brings attention to the number of enormous river dam projects that are happening all over South America, but especially in places like Brazil, which are usually more often they're hydroelectric dams. So they're damming water or damming rivers in order to generate electricity. And these dam projects tend to override environmental rights that are in law, but there are other laws in places like Brazil overriding those environmental rights. And this has been kind of highlighted by another artist I've written about called Carolino Quecedo, who looks at this disaster of the Mariana Dam, but also at the hydroelectric projects that have taken place all over Brazil and on the border with Paraguay. She interviews people who have been affected by these dams and the way that the damming up of their river prevents them from obtaining food that they used to be able to obtain from the river, like fish and so on. And what the rivers meant to these, or what rivers mean to these people, because rivers are incredibly symbolic and they relate to traditional local religions. And Quecedo has also done this project called Be Damned, which looks at 15 mega dams in her ancestral home, which is Colombia, and investigates these huge projects which completely changed the way local environments have always been. I was, you know, thinking when I was writing about this, about the way that capitalism at the moment is really ripping up the rule book about about water. And these huge dams are happening in large amounts of, all over Latin America. But at the same time, this year we've had Donald Trump talking about invading Greenland, and the reason he wants to go to Greenland is to drill through the ice to obtain minerals that he needs, that we need, that capitalism needs, like lithium and copper. And at the same time this year, we've had this disastrous new legislation in Argentina, which is where I'm based a lot of the time, allowing mining to happen in glacial regions. I'm sure that, and I mean, that will directly affect the area where I live, which is in, you know, southern Patagonia, which is, of course, it's the Andes. It's partially glacial in places. So I'm sure mining will start in the next few years in a lot of very, very remote places and beautiful places. But it's also tribal land. It's Mapuche indigenous land. And it will make worse relationships between the Argentinian government and the Chilean government. Patagonia goes across the border into Chile. Mapuche people live on both sides of that border, and they will, and they've already been, you know, there's over 100 years of conflict between them and the national government of Chile and the national government of Argentina, and it will just become worse.
You mentioned something called Modatima, the Movement for the Defense of Water, Land and Environmental Protection, and artist Patricia Dominguez. What's the connection there? What does she do?
She's Chilean, and I first saw a piece of work of her called the Ballad of the Dry Mermaids, which I found very amusing because it's got these sculptural forms of avocados with.
Oh yeah.
And of course, the avocado industry in Chile is absolutely enormous, and it uses, especially in this area called Petorca, there are these corporate farms which have collaborated, you know, the farmers, the owners of the farms have collaborated with corrupt local politicians to privatize the water supply, which is denying water to thousands of people, but it's all in order to grow more and more avocados. And I'm quite sure if you go and buy avocados at your local supermarket, it's quite likely to be a Chilean avocado. But the way she makes these avocados come to life in her sculptures is really funny. I mean, she's a very interesting artist who I found out in an interview with her that her grandfather, who lived in the Atacama Desert in Chile, started his own museum. And she's based a lot of her ideas about the idea of having your own museum and having your own fantastical forms that you can put together. And her grandfather discovered a fossilized whale skeleton in the Atacama Desert, and he built his own museum, as I said, and he discovered a colony of green turtles. And he defended his area against the thermoelectric coal plant that was being planned. So she's kind of got it in her family.
It's in her blood. But obviously, and she's using perhaps humour as a way of, I mean, you do, there is a link, isn't there, in a way, quite often between protest and art and things that people make to use in protests. And humour is obviously, and satire is something that... you know, it's politically a tool people use a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And I presume her approach to making art is quite different to the first artist we discussed, you know, where it's like the immersive experience, the shock thing.
Yeah. I was quite interested in the different varieties of art, actually, that are looking at water. I mean, I was very interested in the Mexican artist Tania Candiani, who has produced this piece of work called The Names of Water, which includes 22 sandstone sculptures, which she developed by interviewing members of the indigenous community in Sierra Huasteca in the eastern side of Mexico, where every year, one night every year, everybody tries to name everything in the universe.
I thought that was wonderful. I thought that was actually a wonderful idea.
Oh, yeah. So
well, it's obviously a year isn't enough, is it?
No, but you do it all in a night so that, according to the ritual, when you wait, the following morning when the sun comes up, everything can continue to exist for another year. And I think, yeah, it's a wonderful idea. But she interviewed people talking about water, and then she used to, when she was video editing the interviews, she found that the waveform for the word water in different dialects among different people looked slightly different, but also slightly the same. And she was very interested in the way, in the similarities and the slight differences of the waveforms. And she turned the waveform visuals that she could see into a series of 3D sculptures that I think are remarkably beautiful. They look like these very interesting photos that are taken of water droplets falling on into water, where the water droplet will change shape and very, very slightly, and then when it hits the water, it creates other wave patterns. And I think that these images, these sculptures are incredibly beautiful as a result of trying to solidify something that you can't solidify.
But also to draw attention to the value of water or the beauty of water, presumably to make people care about it. Yes. Or think about it.
Yes, yes.
I'm fascinated really by the difference between this kind of approach to making art,
yeah,
and the kind that Dan was talking about. And they strike me as one has a deep understanding of the complications of, I suppose, language and the way history is, you know. So, and the other type is almost like it wants to just have an effect at when it's being made and where it's being made, and an immediacy of intention of an effect. And I'm fascinated whether you'd like to say anything about this. Dan, would you like to say anything about what you think about that?
I think about this a lot. I would sort of formulate a little bit as something like a kind of dialectic between philosophy and politics, because politics is as an instrumental aspect to politics. And if you think art can sort of become activism, then there's kind of real world things to change, and there is a way in which art is activated in that arena. And on the other side, the kind of the price for philosophical negativity is a kind of political impotence. So, and this is the negativity of Benjamin and Adorno that says, well, capitalism is now total, right? So we think inside it. And so these expressions of potential positive change make us feel like we're doing something, but potentially lead us, you know, in a way, you know, this is part of the issue I was going to raise in a question related to like the Anthropocene, which is, or the Hydrocene, or any other coined term, is that they have, for what they produce productively in terms of theory and the amount of books that are written and the careers that have come off the back of it, there's clearly an element in which that theory itself is also partaking in the capitalist exchange you know, it's becoming part of the reproduction itself, you know. So the negative philosophical tradition of critique is to say, well, change is actually impossible as things are now. The best we can do is register an understanding of that. And that maintains the possibility things might be different in the future. It's not wholly negative. So yeah, that's how I'd think about it.
Well, very well put. But it's interesting you say it doesn't stop the possibility of there being potential change in the future. Where does that hope come from?
Well, it comes from it comes from a kind of form of remembering, you know. So art, for it's like for Adorno especially, artworks are a kind of a remembering of a more like a natural interaction, human interaction, for example. It's not something that you can immediately redeem and feel good about, but it's something that for example, if you produce images of utopia, you know, what happens is they all inevitably fail or become appropriated by capital. And then you get reactionary movements against that, counter-reactionary, and then the hope, the initial hope, turns into something else. Whereas you could argue that the more utopian perspective is to say, well, we're gonna see what the reality of this, how impossibly difficult the reality of this situation is, and understand it for what it is, and then kind of curtail our expectations accordingly. You know, in terms of like diagnostics, there's something potentially more promissory about that in the future if you are able to sort of say how bad things are.
So understanding of what you would describe as a reality, and it might be an incredibly complex one that's very hard to understand, is better than not understanding where you really are. And yeah, I'm thinking you can just change it from. Sorry. Yeah.
Well, human thought itself follows modes of capitalist reproduction, so it's not like we can retreat into our minds and just separate ourselves. So anything that appears reconciled is, on some level, reconciled with capitalist reproduction, and so. The difficult thing is maintaining the contradiction, maintaining the unreconciled. But I don't, you know, these things can take different forms. And I think what I liked about Bob's piece was that it, in a way, it felt like a kind of speculative, curatorial project. It was almost like, there was a group exhibition that had been produced in the essay, you know.
Yeah.
And that's very different from like a theorist pushing a term to mobilizing the term.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, Dan. I didn't want to originally in the piece when I wrote it, I didn't want to use the word hydrocene. I think it's a bit sort of I just wanted to draw attention to it, but I think the big difference between I've been thinking about and experiencing in Latin America is this sort of sense of crisis. You know, it's the artists I've been looking at are reporting really about reality that's happening to thousands of people. And I think that the idea of, you know, the theme of water is a hugely important one in large amounts of many countries in Latin America, and so it's real life. It's not. You know, that's why I was asking you about Benjamin and architecture in Europe versus the experience of European architecture in Latin America, which is colonial, basically. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And this is an extended form of colonialism. This the whole crisis affecting water is capitalism and colonialism. It's still dominant. And so, but coming into contact with people, artists who are in touch with, in some cases, like this artist Seba Calfuqueo, who I ended up writing about, who's a Chilean Mapuche heritage trans artist who equates, I think, water with her own experience of sexuality, and as well,
fluidity,
as
the fluidity is it?
The fluidity, yes, exactly, yes.
Yeah, that was really interesting that you found. I didn't expect to see that. Was a bit of a left field bringing in of that, the trans aspect. I hadn't considered that coming into your feature when I reached that point.
Well, you keep discovering things, don't you?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I think it's wonderful that you are drawing attention to these people who I don't know, and a whole, you know, the urgency of their situation and their attempts to deal with it. It's fascinating. Sure. I mean, both your features have great value in different ways, and it's interesting. And I'm very pleased that perhaps I've been able to help you bring out some of those in this program, he said, trying to be as professional as possible to wind it up. We are nearly at the end. I thank you both. I'm going to ask you to stop now and thank the listener too, and encourage them, as I said at the beginning, to read these two features. They are in the July August summer issue 2026 of Art Monthly, number 498. We are creeping towards our 50th year.
Wow.
And our 500th issue in October. I don't know when you're listening to this. It might be a podcast and that might be long gone. But if you are listening to it soon after it's made, you can look forward to those issues following. And I'm sure these guys will probably write again for Art Monthly in the future. I hope they do. So let me get your names right. Bob Dickinson, thank you so much. And Dan Rees, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Enjoy the heat wave, both of you.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Art Monthly Talk Show. Can we just encourage you to consider subscribing to Art Monthly, which you can do on our website, which is www.artmonthly.co.uk. And on the homepage, there's a buy button. If you go there, you can decide to subscribe digitally or in print. You can also do both. And if you do the digital subscription, it gives you access to the entire archive of Art Monthly going back to 1976, which is 500 issues in October 2026, and you can search this archive, and it's a very useful resource. Thank you so much for listening to the Art Monthly Talk Show once again. Goodbye.